From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. The trial of the former Minneapolis police officer charged with killing George Floyd has begun. The prosecution opened by playing the video of Derek Chauvin pressing his knee into Floyd's neck. Here's attorney Jerry Blackwell.
For his excessive use of force against George Floyd, that was an assault that contributed to taking his life, and for engaging in imminently dangerous behavior, putting a knee on the neck, the knee on the back, for 9 minutes and 29 seconds without regard for Mr. Floyd's life. We're going to ask that you find him guilty of murder in the second degree, murder in the third degree, and second degree manslaughter.
NPR reporter Matt Sepik joins us now on Skype from Minneapolis. Matt, welcome.
Hi there.
So we heard from the prosecution there. The defense is drawing attention to other circumstances surrounding Floyd's death. Here's attorney Eric Nelson.
You will learn that Derek Chauvin did exactly what he had been trained to do over the course of his 19-year career. The use of force is not attractive, but it is a necessary component of policing.
A medical examiner ruled that Floyd's death was in fact a homicide. So how is the defense going to get around that?
Well, defense attorneys are expected to point at other factors that medical examiner Dr. Andrew Baker found in his autopsy. Floyd's cause of death will be at the center of the defense case, particularly the drugs. Baker found fentanyl and methamphetamine in Floyd's system and other medical factors as well. What the defense is trying to do here is create reasonable doubt in the mind of at least one juror that it was something else besides Derek Chauvin's knee that led to Floyd's death in May of 2020 at the age of 46.
Well, to that point, the judge in the case had previously ruled that the defense could not use a body cam video of police arresting George Floyd during a different traffic stop back in 2019. Now he has changed his mind. He will allow them to use some of that video. Why do Chauvin's lawyers want the jury to see it?
Well, Cahill ruled earlier this month that there is some relevance to Floyd's May 2019 arrest because his physical reaction to that confrontation with police was similar to the way he reacted in the fatal encounter a year later. Now, Cahill is only allowing a portion of the body camera video from that 2019 incident, as well as some testimony regarding Floyd's blood pressure, statements to the paramedics who treated him that day, as well as the suspected drugs in his car. This is really about medical evidence. Cahill said the paramedic can testify that Floyd had high blood pressure during that day in 2019, and it was so high that he was at risk of a stroke or heart attack. But the judge is not allowing any evidence of Floyd's emotional state from the 2019 encounter, including the fact that he called out for his mother as he did in 2020. So that will be very limited.
I see. Well, the prosecution, we know they will be relying on that now infamous video of Chauvin restraining Floyd in 2020 with a knee on the neck. The video, of course, sparked a protest movement around the world. What else will the prosecution be relying on to convince the jury?
You're right that that video is key. That was the first thing they played this morning during the opening statements. They plan to call a lot of expert witnesses, as well as other Minneapolis police officers and the chief, Madeira Arredondo, to talk all about the use of force, what's acceptable policy and what's not. I expect that they'll continue to argue what Prosecutor Jerry Blackwell previewed this morning, that Floyd was handcuffed, subdued, never threatened anyone, and the force that Chauvin used was far in excess of what was necessary to subdue him. They're also expected to introduce what's called spark of life testimony. We'll likely hear from Floyd's family and friends about the person that he was, a father, a brother. This is all an effort to humanize him. However, this will be limited too because it could open the door to the prosecution bringing in testimony about negative aspects of Floyd's past, such as his earlier run-ins with the law, including an armed robbery conviction from 2007. Cahill has prohibited jurors from hearing about that. Cahill said testimony about whether Floyd was a peaceful person or someone prone to violence could allow the defense to introduce evidence of his criminal record and less savory parts of his past.
Tell us more about the jury pool that both sides have agreed upon.
Well, it's 9 women and 5 men hearing the case, 14 in all. 2 of them are alternates, so only 12 will deliberate once everything is done, once testimony is finished here in really about a month. The jury includes 6 people of color. That is far more diverse than Hennepin County, Minnesota as a whole, which is around 70% white. Of the 6 jurors who are people of color, 2 are biracial women. One's a black woman who grew up in the area of South Minneapolis where Floyd was killed. She's retired. And 3 are black men. Of those black men, 2 are immigrants. So it is definitely a diverse jury, given the demographics of this area.
NPR's Matt Sepik following this case for us. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Backlash continues over Georgia's new, more restrictive voting law. Critics are calling for a boycott of the state after the Republican governor signed the measure into law last week. And while Georgia is just one of dozens of states trying to reduce voting access, other states are trying to increase it. Specifically, mail-in voting used by tens of millions of people during the pandemic. In Massachusetts, Republican Governor Charlie Baker just signed a bill to extend temporary mail-in voting until the end of June. Democrats in the state legislature promised to make it permanent. As WBUR's Anthony Brooks reports, the debate over vote-by-mail has become a red-hot partisan issue.
Among the biggest advocates of vote-by-mail in Massachusetts is Secretary of State William Galvin, a Democrat.
Because it allows the voting to be done at the convenience of the voter, it extends to voters more time, more reason. It'll, in effect, add people to the discussion, which is a very important thing.
Starting last July, amidst the pandemic, Massachusetts gave voters the right to vote by mail for any reason. The new law, signed by Governor Baker, extends that measure to the end of June. That will help voters in a number of local elections. It will also give lawmakers time to make the law permanent. Galvin has a bill to do that, one of several being considered by the state legislature.
In effect, it's no excuse absentee voting.
This comes as many other states, particularly ones controlled by Republicans, are moving in the opposite direction. Myrna Perez directs the Voting Rights and Election Program at the Brennan Center for Justice. She says 43 states have introduced more than 250 bills that would make it harder to vote.
On the other hand, we are seeing some states like Massachusetts introduce a slew of bills that would make it easier for people to vote. This demonstrates that we do have two Americas.
In a country now defined by political polarization, vote by mail has become one of the hottest flashpoints. Charles Stewart III, an MIT professor who studies election data, says former President Trump has a lot to do with that.
You have a Republican president, for reasons that still mystify me and a lot of people, begins a relentless attack on voting by mail. And voters listen to their partisan leaders.
This election was rigged. And the Supreme Court and other courts didn't want to do anything about it.
Trump is still pushing baseless claims of election fraud and attacking vote by mail. Here he is in February at the Conservative Political Action Conference in Orlando.
We should eliminate the insanity of mass and very corrupt mail-in voting.
But Stewart says there's no particular reason for Republicans to oppose vote by mail.
I like to remind people that before this election, absentee ballots were considered to be a Republican mode of voting.
Stewart points out that during the disputed 2000 presidential election, it was a Republican, George W. Bush, who benefited from mailed-in absentee ballots in Florida. Now, many Republicans oppose expanding vote by mail. In Massachusetts, when the House voted to extend it, GOP Chairman Jim Lyons blasted the move as a complete and total disgrace. He accused lawmakers of ramming through controversial legislation without hearings or debate. Paul Craney, executive director of the Conservative Massachusetts Fiscal Alliance, largely agrees.
It passed the House without a single hearing, without a single vote in the House. The Senate did a quick written testimony period that lasted for one weekend. People are a little bothered by that.
Craney says lawmakers should have first studied how mail-in voting actually worked in the last election. Secretary of State Galvin says he's not surprised Republicans are skeptical of vote by mail because he believes it helps Democrats.
It's generally empowered people of color, minority voters. It's generally empowered urban voters. It's generally empowered younger voters. Those are general statements that I don't have statistical evidence for right at this moment, I believe they're accurate.
State records confirm that after Massachusetts approved vote by mail, more people voted in the state than ever before, nearly half of them by mail. According to exit polls from the November election, the overwhelming majority of ballots cast by mail in Massachusetts, 84%, came from Democrats. So does that mean vote by mail gives Democrats an advantage? Stewart of MIT has studied years of elections involving mail-in ballots. His conclusion?
There's no evidence that mail voting helps or hurts either party intrinsically. None.
Stewart's assessment is backed up by a new study from Stanford University. It found that vote by mail did not substantially increase Democratic turnout relative to Republican turnout. It said voter interest is what drove higher turnout in 2020, not changes to voting rules. Advocates say this supports their argument for making vote by mail permanent, that it's not about partisan advantage. It's about making voting easier for everyone. For Here and Now, I'm Anthony Brooks.
President Joe Biden faces the same frustrating challenge his predecessors did: what to do about Afghanistan. The Trump administration signed a deal with the Taliban that requires the withdrawal of all American troops by May 1st. During his first press conference, Biden was asked about whether he'll be able to live up to that agreement.
The answer is that it's going to be hard to meet the May 1 deadline. Just in terms of tactical reasons, hard to get those troops out. So what we've been doing, what I've been doing, and what Secretary Blinken has been doing, has been we've been meeting with our allies, those other nations that have NATO allies who have troops in Afghanistan as well. And if we leave, we're going to do so in a safe and orderly way.
Our next guest has also wrestled with the challenges posed by Afghanistan. Chuck Hagel served as Secretary of Defense during the Obama administration. Earlier, he was a Republican senator representing Nebraska. And he joins us now. Secretary Hagel, welcome back to Here and Now.
Thank you, Jane.
Secretary, if you were in President Biden's cabinet today, what would be your advice about Afghanistan?
Well, I think what he said was a good starting point. When he said it's going to be difficult to have our troops out by May 1st, the fact is the past administration did not think this through very well. First of all, to set a date and set that date without the involvement of the Afghan government in the peace talks sent a very clear signal to the Taliban that we were leaving the Afghan government behind. So that was the first problem. And it was unrealistic to think that we would have troops out of there by May 1st. And in 2014, when I was secretary, we brought tens of thousands of troops out of Afghanistan, thousands of platforms and assets, closed hundreds of bases. And it took months and months and months to do it right. And plus, we've got NATO allies there. They've got more troops than we do. We've got other nations' allies, not just NATO allies there. That should have been coordinated with them. So I think President Biden is in a difficult spot. He knows it. He's been there before. And I think the answers he gave were probably the only ones that he could give.
So the May 1st deadline aside then, Secretary, President Biden said that he couldn't picture American troops being in Afghanistan next year. What did you think when you heard that? Realistic?
Well, I think that's realistic. I support it, by the way. We can't continue this forever war. We've been there almost 20 years. And yes, we've got interest there. We've got issues in Pakistan and Iran, obviously. That in Central Asia area is dangerous. Possibility of Al-Qaeda, other ISIS terrorist groups coming in as they already are there. What threat does that present to us? How can we continue to support the Afghan government? We've got allies that are involved in this. So it's a difficult spot, but I think we've got to start thinking through how do we unwind this and how do we do it responsibly?
Well, the Taliban are clearly listening, Secretary, as you know, after President Biden's statement about not meeting the May 1st deadline. The Taliban issued a statement threatening to resume attacks on foreign troops if those troops don't leave. Are those credible threats to your mind?
They are credible threats, and I think we'll have to be prepared for that. But the fact is, the Taliban didn't live up to all the commitments they made in the original peace agreement that they had made with the previous administration without the involvement of the Afghan government. And we essentially said to the Afghan government, President Ghani's government, here's the deal. This is what you're going to live by and abide by. But yet the Taliban continued to attack the government forces, even after thousands of Taliban prisoners were released. And the Afghan government lived up to most of its commitments that I'm aware of. So that's the reality of what we've got. But I don't think that you've got any other option here. You can't just arbitrarily, unilaterally pull our troops out in our assets and close bases, plus thousands of NATO troops and other countries who have troops there in the next month. That's unrealistic and very, very irresponsible.
And yet I suspect a lot of people listening right now may be thinking, you know, after 20 years of fighting, what is the American national security interest in Afghanistan in 2021?
Well, I think the answer there is the same national security interests that we had 20 years ago, when we know that Afghanistan was used as a training ground for the terrorists who attacked our country 20 years ago. And it's more sophisticated and more dangerous now, with more terrorist groups, better armed, better organized, better funded. And yes, there are risks and there are realities that we have to factor in. That's what I was referring to earlier when I said this has got to be done responsibly and with all our allies, and should have been done with the Ghani government from the beginning, not having us do the deal, the United States, with the Taliban, and then forcing the deal on the Ghani government.
Secretary Hagel, you went to Afghanistan in 2008 with then Senators Joe Biden and John Kerry. Did you think at that time that we'd still be in Afghanistan 13 years later?
I didn't know, quite frankly. I remember the hearings that we used to have in the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, which I was a member of that committee, and the Intelligence Committee, I was a member of that committee, and asking, where are we going? How long are we going to be there? What's our mission? Is this a nation building operation? Or are we trying to build a state? Are we trying to support their government? I mean, what is our role, and how long do we anticipate we'll be there? What's our exit strategy? And I don't think we ever came up with any good answers. I think that we got in very quickly for a clear reason. But beyond that, I don't think we ever thought it through. And so when I was there many, many times. And yes, in 2008, Jack Reed and I went over to Afghanistan with then Senator Obama. He asked us to go with him. He had not been to the Middle East very much in Afghanistan. He hadn't been there at all in some of those areas. But as Secretary of Defense, that was my first trip in early 2013, and that's where I went. So I'm not an expert, but I've been there a number of times. I know the players, and it's complicated a place as there is in the world, because mm-hmm. if you study history, and I don't think we always do a very good job of understanding the culture and the society and the history of a country before we get ourselves involved, that country has never been ruled by a central government. Empires have tried to rule it and have all been defeated. So I don't think we ever understood the immensity of the task or the complications that we're going to be involved in being in Afghanistan.
Well, and that makes me think about, well, of course, you know, you were a Vietnam War veteran. And to your point, I wonder if you think that after all these years of fighting in Afghanistan, that we'll end up with yet another American war that ends without anything that even resembles victory.
Well, unfortunately, Jane, that's probably where we're headed. It pains me to say that, because of the sacrifices made by our men and women over there. Over the years, I mean, probably a couple trillion dollars when it's all added up, maybe more, that American taxpayers have invested. Have we done some good? I think absolutely. We've done a lot of good over there. But this can't go on, as I said, forever. And we are going to have to leave. And it's a tough call. And it's not going to make everybody happy. And there's going to be unfairness to it. But it's just the reality of the kind of world that we're in. And it didn't start with this war. I mean, you mentioned Vietnam. Vietnam was another one of those wars that, in my opinion, we should have never gotten into. But we did, and it cost us 58,000 lives and an awful lot of money and standing in the world. So those are the realities and the complications and the complexities that a president faces daily, not just Joe Biden.
And so, Secretary Hagel, what have we learned then over these many years from this exercise? You say we never figured out the mission or the enemy or the culture. What have we learned?
Well, I hope we've learned a lot. I hope as we look to the future and before we engage again in invading and occupying a country like Afghanistan, Iraq, our involvement in Libya, I think those were all big mistakes. And we didn't learn very much, I think, from Vietnam. I hope we'll learn something from this. Not that we don't have a noble idea, but you cannot lead with force. Force must back up diplomacy, but you have to lead with diplomacy and diplomatic efforts and working with allies. That's what we should have learned. And sometimes force is required, and we have to be ready for that. But we have to be smart in how we apply that force. But it should be secondary to the diplomatic effort and support the diplomatic effort if force is required.
Former Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thanks, Jane.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from Zooty. Why spend months coding when you can build powerful, customized applications in days? Zooty offers an affordable solution to build apps for your business, apps that integrate into all your current systems and data sources. And your Zooty subscription always includes unlimited apps and unlimited users. Learn more at Zooty.com.
How is COVID changing the college experience? What's driving the increase in crossings at the border? Why did Colorado's gun laws fail to prevent a mass shooting there? Listen for answers, backstory, and analysis beyond the day's headlines on Consider This from NPR.
If you're looking to buy a house right now in many parts of the country, you'll likely run into a little bit of trouble. A record low housing supply is pushing prices up by about 15% nationwide compared to last year. Let's bring in Jill Schlesinger, CBS News business analyst and host of Jill on Money. Hi, Jill.
Hello.
What a market. Very quickly, take us back a year ago when the pandemic shut down the country. What was going on in the market then, and how did it lead us to where we are now?
Well, I think that back then there were so many unknowns. And the first idea was, well, if we are all staying at home, we are certainly not going to have would-be buyers traipsing through our homes if we were thinking about selling. But if you then fast forward into the summer, I think we had a much better idea of who was going to be able to work from home. There were a lot of people who kept their jobs and were making money, and they saw low mortgage interest rates. And they also felt like, I need more space. If I'm going to be working at home, if my spouse is going to be working at home, if we've got some kids who are learning from home.
Yeah.
And this was a driving market. And if you look at where housing inventory has gone over the last year, down by almost 30%. Mm. Properties are selling about in 20 days. That is a record low, even including that hot housing market of the 2000s.
So a really incredibly competitive market right now, barely any houses to buy. The latest data shows that at the end of February, there were about 1 million existing housing units on the market in the entire country, Jill. What does this mean for buyers?
It's tough. The problem really has become that with so many people flooding into the market and with existing stocks still pretty low, you are going to pay a lot of money. I mean, the median existing home sales price is at $313,000. That's up almost 16% from a year ago. And new home sales, not better, because actually cost of materials like lumber and crude oil and copper wire all shooting up. Median sales price of a new house in February, almost $350,000. So it is expensive to buy a house in this country.
Well, and millennials are entering the housing market in record numbers. How are they shaking things up?
The share of first-time home buyers up to 36% last year. That's from 31% in the previous 2 years. And I will say that they have changed the way we're buying homes, and it's fascinating to me. You know, a recent Zillow survey found that almost 4 in 10 millennials said they'd be comfortable buying a home online, totally, without ever seeing it in person.
Wow.
Almost 6 in 10 said they would be confident making an offer on a home they toured virtually only.
That's incredible. Okay, so if you're thinking about buying a house right now, what should you consider?
Don't forget to add an item for upkeep and maintenance. It's usually 1% to 3% of the purchase price every single year. And also factor in the transaction itself. You know, closing costs, they're rising. We saw closing costs go for average about $6,000 last year, as much as $10,000 or $15,000 in hot markets. So you got to run the numbers. And the most important thing that I can tell you is that when you're looking at a home, you've got to make sure that buying that house will allow you to do other things in your financial life. You've got to be able to pay down those student loans. You want to be able to put money into your retirement account. You know, my mom was a realtor for many years. And one of the things she would tell the frustrated would-be buyers, she would say, you know, a house is like a man. There's more than one for you in the world.
So true. That's Jill Schlesinger, CBS News business analyst and host of Jill on Money. Jill, thank you so much.
Great to be with you.
Democrats in the U.S. Senate are optimistic that they can reach a bipartisan consensus on universal background checks for gun purchases following mass shootings in Boulder and Atlanta. But is that the right solution? University of Arizona sociologist Jennifer Carlson has studied this topic for over a decade. She co-wrote a recent editorial in the New York Times arguing that U.S. policymakers should be looking at other ways to prevent gun violence, focusing instead on the trauma that ripples out from a shooting. Jennifer Carlson joins us now. And Professor, you write that gun trauma goes far beyond the 40,000 lives taken each year by gun violence and the 115,000 people injured by guns. What kind of toll has it taken on all of us?
I mean, it's everything from obviously the lives that have been taken, the families, communities that have been impacted. You know, we can see it in terms of how it's impacted, you know, everyday decisions like where we choose to live, if we're privileged to have that choice, when we go out, where we go out, you know, how late at night we stay out. It has shaped how parents talk to their children. It's really sort of impacted our psyches in a way that, again, goes above and beyond sort of the people that are most directly impacted by gun violence.
You said an important word there, I think, privilege. We know that gun violence itself affects certain groups of people disproportionately. I assume that means the same thing is true for the trauma that ripples out from it.
Yeah, and this is something that I think is really important as we talk about gun violence as an epidemic, because that's a very powerful framing, because it suggests that this is something that is major. It's not just individual level, it's society level. But epidemic often has this connotation that it affects society evenly, that everybody's equally at risk. And that's not the case with gun violence. Even in the case of school shootings, which are often framed as types of gun violence associated with white middle-class schools, African-American students are actually much more likely to be exposed to a school shooting, to gun violence in the school. So it's definitely the case that communities of color, under-resourced communities, underserved communities are much more likely to bear the burden of not just gun violence, but gun trauma.
Hmm. You write about a cycle of gun violence and trauma. Trauma leads to fear, which leads to anger, and that can then create more violence. Can you talk about that cycle more?
Yeah, I mean, this is something that I think psychologists and sociologists have looked at how violence, the experience of violence within a community, concentrated within a community, affects sort of capacities, whether that's at the sort of individual psychological level or even community capacity. One of the cyclical elements is most certainly more gun violence, but it's also, you know, in terms of things beyond gun violence, like political engagement and the capacity to organize as a community, for example. That's Robert Vargas's work on Chicago. So, and then that in turn creates the context for gun trauma to take even deeper root. And so when we're thinking about gun policy, we have to think about that element if we want to sort of really get at the roots of what's going on with gun violence in America.
This is become a wildly partisan issue. And for that reason, there hasn't been any meaningful change in 25 years or more, because people tend to just retreat into their corners whenever they have a conversation about this.
Well, I think that the part of the way that you get past the politics is actually seeing the solutions that are already being forged that are out there but aren't seen as, quote unquote, part of the gun debate or part of doing gun politics. There's community embedded organizations. So the Violence Interrupters, Youth Alive, these are groups that are actually doing the work of putting trauma at the center of what I would argue gun policy on the ground, you know, working with people who have survived gun violence in the immediate aftermath to offer them resources on how to heal and not just fall back into this trauma violence cycle. And so that kind of work, you know, we debate universal background checks and red flag laws, and these are all things that we should be debating, but we also need to bring this kind of gun violence work to the fore, because it's what will do the deeper healing work that we need to do in order to address gun violence, not just in terms of the statistics, but in terms of the very deep psychological toll it's taken on American society.
So what do you say to a gun owner who doesn't buy your trauma argument, who says that it is, you know, his or her right to own a gun, and in fact, those guns make them safer? Would you tell that person that they have been a victim of gun trauma?
You know, one thing that I think is really crucial to remember is that the number one reason why people own guns in this country is for self-defense. And we can debate on what that really means, what is actually at the root of that fear. But at some level, fear is operating, right? And I think that, you know, I've talked to dozens of gun owners, gun carriers, gun instructors, and fear is, you know, if we're honest, fear is operating on both sides of the debate. And so I really think of gun trauma as a way to sort of elevate the debate to acknowledging that fear and recognizing that we actually share that fear. So that's what I would say to someone who's like, why are we talking about trauma? I think it's a way to elevate the debate.
Jennifer Carlson is a sociologist at the University of Arizona. We're going to link you to her editorial for the New York Times at hereandnow.org. Jennifer, thank you for your time.
Thank you so much.
New York State is launching a new phone app that will allow people to quickly show their coronavirus testing and vaccination status. Officials say the Excelsior Pass will give people quicker access to gatherings, including sports arenas and large weddings, where the state's public health rules are still in effect. NPR's Brian Mann reports in this story, which originally aired on Weekend Edition.
There are still thousands of new coronavirus cases confirmed in New York every day and dozens of deaths. The challenge, says Mark Doerr with the New York State Hospitality and Tourism Association, is reopening more places like sports arenas and Broadway theaters when the coronavirus is still lurking.
I think confidence is the biggest dilemma, I guess, to overcome as we head into the busy season. Confidence in getting people out to travel.
So New York State partnered with IBM to create a smart device app that includes a scannable barcode similar to the one used in airline boarding passes. They say it's voluntary, it's free to download, it keeps most of your personal information private. Doerr says business venues can check customers' barcodes to find out if they've been vaccinated or tested negative for the coronavirus within the last 3 days.
The business will be able to really quickly recognize that the proper protocols have been followed in order to have a safe entry into the business.
From the start of the pandemic, smart devices have been used for contact tracing and public health alerts, but this appears to be the first app in the U.S. that shows this kind of personal coronavirus status, though officials in Hawaii are working on a similar vaccine passport. Melissa Fleischhut, who heads the New York State Restaurant Association, doesn't think smaller venues like restaurants and bars are likely to use the app. But she points out many businesses that host larger crowds, including caterers and wedding organizers, are still required to follow strict public health rules. That includes making sure people are vaccinated or have recent negative tests. Until now, she says, checking people's status was super inefficient.
Paper, for example, or an Excel spreadsheet or something like that.
She thinks this app will help, and she agrees it might give people a little more confidence when venturing back into venues with really big crowds.
You know, if you knew that everybody in that area near you had either tested negative or had received the vaccine, you know, I think you could feel pretty good about going to those events and feeling comfortable even when the numbers got really high like that.
Some large sports and concert arenas, including Madison Square Garden, have already started using the app. New York State's caterers and wedding planners can start using it with their customers April 2nd. Ryan Mann, NPR News.
Our deep political divisions are apparently making it harder for some social studies teachers to do their jobs. But educators say it's essential now for students to understand how to talk to someone they disagree with. All of this, on top of remote learning and hybrid instruction, makes already tough conversations even more challenging. Lee Gaines from member station WILL takes us into some classrooms that are working to bridge the divides.
Okay, let me put my specs on so I can see who's here.
Kelly Keough takes attendance in his social studies class at Normal Community High School in Central Illinois. About 10 students sit in front of him. The rest are doing remote instruction. Each group takes on a different lesson for today. With his in-person class, Keough begins a discussion about polarization in American politics.
What's the magic word that we find in the Constitution? They predicated the entire document around this word, and I think if we look back at that film, there's a word that former Speaker Boehner couldn't even bring himself to say in the course of an interview. Yeah.
Compromise.
Keough has taught history and social studies since the mid-1980s. He says political polarization has gotten worse, and it's seeped into the classroom.
Today, I mean, if you announce that you're on this side of an issue, very often you're immediately, the communication shuts down. And so trying to get my students to hear an opposing viewpoint and be open, it's a challenge.
It is much more challenging to teach civics now than it has been in the past, but it's also, I would argue, much more necessary.
Diana Hess is the dean of the School of Education at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. She studies how middle and high school students learn about politically controversial issues. Hess says schools aren't to blame for political polarization, but they could be a part of the solution. The key, she says, is teaching students how to talk to and respect the political views of those they disagree with.
I do think overall, we will find that if, you know, lots and lots of young people are taught how to do that, that should at some point begin to have an effect on political polarization.
But Hess cautions that not all views deserve respect, like those based on misinformation or racist ideology. So educators also need to teach students how to become critical consumers of information. Tracy Freeman teaches social studies at Normal West High School, across town from where Kelly Keough teaches. After the January 6th insurrection at the U.S. Capitol, Freeman says she heard from a former student. They told her they went to Washington that day for the Trump rally, but made it clear they didn't go into the Capitol building.
And just wanted to talk again, just wanted to say, like, hey, I came for the rally because, and this is someone who shared that they were a fan of President Trump's, not necessarily a Republican.
Freeman didn't criticize the former student for attending the rally. Instead, she asked them to reflect on what they learned in her class about charismatic leaders and why blind loyalty to anything or anyone is a problem.
My goal was not to make him not be a Trump fan. My goal was to get him to critically think about being in a situation out of loyalty to a person that could have ended up very badly for him.
Freeman says part of her job as a teacher is to stay connected to her students as they develop and question their political opinions. 17-year-old Andrew Harrell loves his civics class at Belleville East High School in Southern Illinois. He says his education has taught him how to talk to people he disagrees with and still be friends.
One of my friends from school is more to the left, and I tend to go the other way. But one thing we value a lot is talking about our differences in ways that we can both coexist, as we have, you know, figured out how to do.
But Harrell is upset by the conversations he sees on social media where people just trade insults.
And if there's no, you know, consequence for it, and if there's no push to communicate in a friendly or respectful way, then it will just drive our country further apart. And that's how a democracy will fall.
Harrell's classmate, Mariah May, is also a 17-year-old senior. She says polarization prevents students who disagree with each other from spending time together.
Like, the pandemic hasn't really helped with that either, because a lot of people have become comfortable going online to express how they feel, and they've become less likely to approach how they would a situation online in person.
May says she hopes a civics education can help normalize respectful in-person political discussions.
All right, guys. Hey, so real quick, will you spritz your desk?
Kelly Keough, the teacher from Normal Community High School, says the pandemic has made it harder to engage students in tough conversations. Some of his full-time remote students keep their cameras turned off during class.
It's almost impossible to have effective discussions, especially on controversial issues, when you're not having any eye contact.
He says those challenging classroom discussions are easier when students are in person. But even then, they're wearing masks. That makes it difficult to interpret facial expressions. But Keough is committed to fostering debate among his students so they'll have the skills they need for the future. For Here and Now, I'm Lee Gaines.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Jane Clayson. This is Here and Now.